What does this story need? What does this story need? What does this story need?
A me interessa molto di più l'inizio che l'infinito.
I discovered that writing, when you write, writing is drawing. I like manuscripts in languages I don't know, because they are drawings, really. You draw with your hand. Of course, you draw letter instead of drawing flowers, but you draw. I was happy the day I discovered that the act of writing is an act of the drawing.
It's a survival instinct. You just have to be romantic to survive in this world. It is like it's one of my favorite quotes from a book by Halldór Laxness, who's an Icelandic author. It's called Christianity Under the Glacier. And the quote is, "The one who does not live in fiction will not survive in this world."
I think for me, it's this idea of really thinking about a poetic approach, which is finding one, something that I'm really passionate about and feel a connection, a deep connection with, and then thinking about a material that can help to both echo it, but also challenge it. Because for me, within the work also, there's this element of opposition and contradiction. There's always something against something else, whether it's in kind of material form or in conceptual form. And that opposition, that tension, is really important part of layering the ideas in the work. And also allowing for other things to happen. You know, it's like, okay, so I may have a particular regard for something, but I'd never want my regard or my interest to override the other possibilities for the viewer and their experience. So it's really about creating almost like a vessel for the viewer to bring their own experience and have that experience as an ingredient for something else to happen. So it's about taking this thing that I'm questioning and then try to figure out how to make it visually dynamic and engaging for somebody want to take time to bring their own experience into it and leave it open enough for that experience to grow into something else. So I think that idea of having a kind of open vessel for the work becomes a kind of open vessel for meaning to revolve, my meaning, their meaning to revolve in a discourse. That's really important. That's what I really try to have the work do.
Sicuramente il mio interesse non è verso la verità, non è verso la storia, nel senso come storia scritta o storia con la S maiuscola, ma è in una narrazione che prende in considerazione le esperienze e il mio intento di creare una nuova esperienza.
The thinking that you are presenting through works of art is a speculative thinking. It's an exercise in trying to figure out how different disciplines, the visual, the perceptual, the philosophical, the social, the speculative, intertwine.
To give sense to things is a political act, but also to refuse to do something that could be considered productive in the standard terms is something very political.
There's a kind of hegemonic understanding in neoliberal cultures that everything can be used, everything can be parceled, everything can be split into smaller parts, everything can be packaged. And I feel like that's a very distinct way to think about what we inhabit. And I think that there are very different realities, so it's not necessarily a way of coping, but it's just a way of understanding our implication in a system that packages.
First of all, the knowledgeable society is a really Western construct. You know, in German they say Wissensgesellschaft. The idea behind this is that it's actually an economic aspect. You know, they say knowledge is the foundation for the building of an economic system. That's what makes the knowledgeable society. So you think it's just about giving knowledge to people so that people know more, but it's about knowing more to make more money. You know, that is what it's about. So that is interesting to understand. Okay, the second part of your question is the economics of knowledge. How to sell knowledge, you know, which of course, your example is for sure brilliant. Because art, in many contexts in the world, is an absolute luxury. So actually, I'm not surprised that we are sitting in a school where students pay, and look at the infrastructure, 5,000 euros to attend. I'm not surprised about that. It is an extremely elitist thing. But then, it is important also to use this knowledge they get or to see how they can reflect more on the society. So if somebody like, I don't know where, to which art school Emeka Ogbo went to, but then he is able to go to the streets of Lagos, put his microphone and capture and narrate a history of that society in a way that has never been done before, you know, from one to one. You know, and that's the brilliant thing about sound. That is why the exhibition is supposed to be a sound exhibition, a different way of narrating contemporary history. So, the economics of knowledge is an interesting thing, and this is an example of it. You know, so it's paying a lot to get knowledge. But I don't know, I cannot judge the quality of the knowledge, you know. But you mentioned something before. This guy sitting, Sadan Afif Spies, sitting there and saying something about mathematics or whatever, you know, and people sit there and ask questions. Why do so many people sit there? Because that is a conventional way of passing through knowledge, especially in the African context, you know. So, you don't need to pay 5,000 euros to get that knowledge. But that knowledge is also very crucial to the working of the society, you know. So the guy that sits there, the griot that sits there and sings and gives the history of whoever sits there and teaches you how to grow this plant or how to deal with this situation is also passing through knowledge. As soon as you write, it has something positive and something negative because you no longer retain it in the original way through which you can embody it. You know, you give it away, you write it, or you record it somehow. So the next generation would not necessarily know how to sing it. They will listen to it. So it's something different. So both have their advantages and their disadvantages. I, for one, I like the legacy of archiving using the body. There's this brilliant publication by Esiaba Irobi where he talks about the body as a site of discourse. You know, the body as a record, as an archive of history, of course, of sound. And he gives the site example of the slaves carrying music, and you get the music 500 years after in the Americas. The sound is, of course, archived. On the one hand, it's important to archive. And I also think that Paul Bowles' archiving and recordings were extremely important. It's another form of document. So all are legitimate, you know. So he who likes the oral part of it should go to that. He who likes the conserved part of it is like tomatoes. You have fresh tomatoes and you have conserved tomatoes. It's everybody's preference.
You know, modernity is a process of dramatization of history. This is it. Modernity tries to dramatize history. And as Schiller put it, modernity tries to find aesthetic dimension to paradoxical situations that they seem impossible together. And more than ever, we are facing these kind of situations, like can the Islam be a source of modernity, for example, like now that we are in the after image of the September 11 attacks and that we are dealing in the news and in our everyday life with questions of how to engage with cultures that have a different perception of values and norms than our own. Can they be a source of modernity? Can they be a source of future? Which is the question. Modernity is good in the sense that modernity always try to dramatize it. They always try to make a script, so to say, of these questions. They did not take them literally. They brought the question to a fictional level. And in that sense, it is important to understand this exercise to see how can we actually understand what's going on. We are in a really interesting time. we are in a certain interregnum, in a moment where several knowledge systems and interpretative devices came to an end, and we need to develop others. So we need to enhance a different vocabulary and different explanatory systems. So it is really challenging, but it's also very scary because we don't know how to deal with that. So in that sense, culture is more actual than ever, and it's really not a question about presenting culture in a historical or ahistorical manner, but it's a question of how can we think along culture? How can we be part of it? Because if we are not part of it, we are just victims of it, or we just be witnesses of something which seems irremediable, that's going to happen to us no matter what. So in that sense, it's really a very interesting moment that equals what happens in certain moments of the 50s. It's about to hybridize the literal meaning, to break it down, like we cannot deal anymore with notions of literality. Notions of truth are also very suspicious to us, so we need to art is a transversal discipline, so we need to apply this methodology to many other inherited knowledges we have, and history is one of them, politics is another one of them, and our interpretation of the political system and all that. So in that sense, as I said, art is a very, very productive field because it allows us for experimenting not only with the visual or with the senses, but with human sciences and come to terms with our intellectual history. I think we need to understand where we are coming from and what we are going towards. So that's not very easy, but if we don't take full responsibility of it.
What happened in the Renaissance, and this is part of my talk too, is that the men of the Renaissance, because men they were mostly, right? The men of the Renaissance, they colonized time, and this is what they did here in Italy mainly. They invented the Middle Ages and the Antiquity in order to say we are the present, we are reborn. But that coincided in the 16th century when they landed in America. They colonized space, and Europe became the center of the world. The present of time and the center of the world. Right? And it was like that is the only universal memory from Greek to Rome to Italy. Now everybody said, hey, some people stole our memory. So what they are doing is kind of remapping time in the sense of the kind of re-emerging, recovering, reinventing their memories. So the colonization of time means not just inventing one time, universal history, but means stealing the memories of other people. And you steal the memory through telling their story because you control the books and you control the languages, but also by stealing artifacts. So the British Museum, the Berlin Museum, the Louvre, and the Tropen Museum, they're kind of living and stealing memories. The colonization of memory implies the colonization of cosmological space. Because with the Bible, which is a cosmological narrative, how the world was created and then how the human species was created, erased the Popol Vuh, erased the Vedic, erased every kind of cosmological narrative. So now, this kind of cosmological narrative of which the Bible became hegemonic in the West, we know, by 18th century, was being displaced by science, by reason. They began to reinvent, for example, the narrative of the human species, the theory of evolution. And with Copernicus and Galileo and all that, they kind of began the scientific explanation of the cosmos. But to that point, it was kind of only explanation. In order to really conquer the space today, you need two things. You need control of knowledge. And the control of knowledge means two things. You have to have a kind of rhetorical, in the sense of Cicero, not rhetorical as formality, discourse that will convince people that that is necessary. And then you have to have the technological knowledge to really send people to the moon. And that is also where the kind of the war of global linear thinking is. Well, already we saw it during the Cold War, but that continued because the Chinese also want to go to space. So now the question is that the colonization of a space is no longer possible to be done by one power. So the Russians are there and the Chinese are there. So the colonization of a space become part of the multipolar world. And that's interesting also to relate to what Carl Schmitt was already seeing at the end of his book. And that was in the 70s. I mean, the article that he added in the 70s. He said, what is going to happen now? What is the view of the future? And he said, well, there are three possibilities. One is that the two powers of the Cold War will kind of reach an agreement and they will kind of peaceful believe in that. The other is that United States and England, the most powerful European empire, will get together and will be hegemonic. Or that will be a multipolar world. And I think that this is a multipolar world, and the colonization of space, again, cannot be done just by United States. And in order to do that, you need knowledge, the two kinds of knowledge, and you have to, in a war of knowledge, I mean, the kind of justification for doing that, but also the technological know-how to do that.
So the algorithmic thinking rather than craft-based thinking, or that the dream of mass customization leads to this condition of a new epistemology, which is based on searching rather than sorting. And David Joselit, the American art historian, talks about it as epistemology of search. And it's a Google logic, and the thing that interests me about it is what you're referring to, which is the relationships between a search and a return is one that's dominated by number or by algorithm. It's not dominated by logical patterns or necessarily affective patterns or the kind of epistemological patterns that we associate with taxonomy or homology or topologies. It's based on who controls the algorithm.
Quest'era in cui tecnologia e scienza finiscono per coincidere, anche l'arte partecipa dal suo contributo, ovviamente con le sue dovute differenze, ad una forma di simultaneità, di comunicazione contemporanea che avviene in tutti i momenti, in tutto il mondo, e quindi diventa, come dire, una sorta di nuova, di ridefinizione di quella che è stata definita da Lotman semiosfera, cioè la sfera della semiotica, la sfera dei segni.
A me poi quello che preme di più nel lavoro non è tanto raccontare avvenimenti importanti per una nazione, insomma. A me interessa raccontare il più possibile storie che sono costruite con elementi concreti. Io ho iniziato registrando perché mi interessava, insomma, che nell'incontro delle persone non andassero perse delle parti del loro racconto, per una questione di distrazione, insomma, ma anche per una diversa qualità dell'attenzione che c'è quando una persona parla rispetto a quando riascolti una registrazione. Poi, riascoltando le registrazioni, mi sono reso conto che effettivamente sono due cose completamente diverse: ascoltare una persona che parla o ascoltare una registrazione del suo racconto. Ed è un po' la differenza che c'è tra memoria e memorizzazione. Cioè, la memoria è quella che riguarda noi personalmente ed è quel lavoro fatto dal supporto nostro naturale, insomma il cervello, le nostre capacità cognitive. La memorizzazione invece è tutta delegata all'oggetto, a un supporto esterno, che può essere come in questo caso un mini disc, un software, un audiocassetta, una videocassetta, insomma. E il rapporto che noi abbiamo con questi oggetti è molto diverso. E persino quando io non riascolto, perché poi la maggior parte delle registrazioni che faccio io non le riascolto, non c'ho tempo, e però il fatto di sapere che c'è un supporto e che stanno da qualche parte mi cambia la mia percezione di quella registrazione. Un po' come quando sono usciti i primi videoregistratori. La maggior parte di noi ha registrato ore e ore, insomma, videocassette, intere nottate fuori orario, che ovviamente non rivedrò mai, insomma, e che probabilmente non rivedrà mai nessuno, nel senso che perché probabilmente quelle videocassette già sono rovinate. Però l'idea stessa che io possa col videoregistratore registrare qualcosa e che poi si possa lavorare sopra, non soltanto facendo un montaggio ad esempio, no, ma anche semplicemente mandando avanti e indietro, avanti veloce, indietro veloce, già questo cambia completamente il rapporto che io ho con l'oggetto memoria. quando io scrivo un diario giorno per giorno, faccio un'operazione completamente diversa rispetto a quando un giorno mi metto seduto e racconto e scrivo la mia vita passata. Perché prima cosa, perché quando io scrivo la mia vita passata in genere è perché voglio tirare somme, invece in un diario al massimo tiri le somme della giornata, ma sai che il giorno dopo riprenderai a scrivere, due giorni dopo, tre giorni dopo e via discorrendo, forse per tutta la vita. E poi perché quando tu scrivi un diario giorno per giorno, in fondo non racconti una storia, racconti una storia quando scrivi un memoriale. La racconti la storia perché sai che quella storia a un certo punto è finita. Allora, alla fine della Seconda Guerra Mondiale, io scrivo la mia storia durante la Seconda Guerra Mondiale, ma perché la Guerra Mondiale è finita. Quella è, secondo me, una differenza più importante, più grande rispetto alla differenza che può avere una videocassetta rispetto a un'audiocassetta, rispetto a un mini disc o a un DVD o a un diario. Il linguaggio non prescinde completamente dal mezzo, ma il diario scritto rispetto a una intervista in audiocassetta potrebbe condividere lo stesso linguaggio, insomma, ed essere diverso solamente per una questione di supporto.
It's a very interesting exercise to understand where are we standing in relationship to the real.
Io sono convinto che col teatro, cioè, non bisogna limitare il teatro a delle forme. Il teatro ha grande potere di poter presentare e prendere posizione su tutto, sulla politica. Dice facciamo teatro, non facciamo politica. È una stronzata grande come una casa. Il teatro è politica. Non esiste un teatro che non si esponga dentro dimensione politica, soprattutto quando è satirico, ma anche quando è tragico. Perché, sempre per l'ignoranza che si ha riguardo alle cose del teatro, Shakespeare, come, non mi sei mai chiesti perché a un certo punto, a 16 anni prima di morire, non fa più il teatro? Non scrive più niente di teatro? Cos'è, non aveva successo? No, era stato cacciato. Basta, gli hanno detto tranquillamente, tu non fai più il teatro, se vuoi vivere. Vuoi fare teatro, sei morto. Chiaro? Fai tutto quello che vuoi, noi ti diamo la possibilità di scrivere poemi lirici, fai la tua vita, hai già fatto tanto, sei famoso. Vai dalle tue parti, dove abiti, stai lì buono e non rompere le scatole.
Nel momento in cui io penso ad un lavoro su cui sto lavorando, devo pensare il più possibile che non mi sto allontanando dalla realtà, ma che è il mio modo di entrare nella realtà, nelle cose.
Moi je travaille uniquement sur les animaux. Sur les animaux imaginaires, quoi, parce que à mon enfance, quand j'allais à l'école, j'étais dans un village où je devais marcher presque 30 à 1 heure de temps dans la forêt pour aller à l'école. Donc, le passage de la forêt me fait entendre les animaux, je voyais les animaux, les oiseaux, tout ça. Mais j'avais peur de les regarder, je les entendais. C'est pourquoi dans mon travail, tu vois des animaux, peut-être des fois tu peux dire ça c'est un oiseau, ça c'est quoi. Mais tu ne peux pas définir les autres animaux, tu ne peux pas dire que ça c'est tel animal, ça c'est tel animal. C'est comme si tu marchais dans la forêt, tu entendais les animaux, mais tu as peur de les regarder. C'est comme le bruit, comme le son de la forêt, de la nature. Des fois quand tu marches, tu entends des choses, tu entends des bruits, tu entends des cris des animaux, mais tu ne peux pas dire ça c'est tel animal. Et moi, à force d'entendre ces sons, ces bruits-là, je commence à comprendre que si un animal bouge par là, dans les herbus, je peux comprendre quelle taille d'animal il a, quel degré de densité il a. C'est là est venu mon travail. C'est comme genre semi-abstrait et semi-figuratif. Parce qu'il faut que tu rentres dedans. C'est comme si tu rentres dans la forêt pour retrouver les animaux dans mon travail.
I'm very interested in alternative modes of learning and alternative ways of knowing and questioning how we know. For me, it's really about communication and resilience. And I think there was an example which is really interesting. I think when people come together to supply their own food, they have to communicate and network and work together. And it's a way of creating a very strong community. So in San Francisco in the 60s, the Black Panthers were a very activist group for the Black movement in the Bay Area. And one way they thought that they could work outside of the system was to control their own food supply. So they started buying food in bulk. So it was a neighborhood would get together and say, hey, let's buy all of our food together. I have a garage. We'll have it all sent to the garage on Wednesdays at 5:00. It comes. And they would ask everyone what they wanted to eat and make a map of it and buy, you know, 50 gallons of milk, 60 gallons of whatever. And on Wednesdays, people would come get the food. And by having to come together and kind of seeing a little bit of transparency of people's daily lives, they also started to organize and say, hey, there's a rally about this issue on Saturday, we should all come. So it became an organizing mechanism, which really strengthened the Black Panther movement. And the project they called it was the Food Conspiracy. The Food Conspiracy was very interesting. How they evolved was the neighborhood started to get stronger, but they felt that they were staying within their neighborhoods and they wanted to have a centralized location to even strengthen the movement. So they got a storefront location and basically kept doing what they're doing. And it's turned into a co-op that still exists called Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco. And it's really a hub of community. It's cooperatively owned and they give a lot of grants to community activism. So I think food has always been, not just bread, but food has always been really, for me, an interesting tool of communication and resilience in terms of being outside of the system and having a way to kind of reconfigure and I say fight back, but it doesn't have to be a forceful fight.
It's a very interesting exercise to understand. It's a very interesting exercise. Where are we standing in relationship to the real?
Where are we standing in relationship to understand
the real?
Where are we standing
in relationship?
Where are we standing? Where are we standing?